Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the mass killings in Africa, particularly looking at the tragic killing of school children in Kampala, Uganda, and general violence against civilians in Africa. I'm joined by two very special guests, Professor Jeanin Tihirugaza and Professor Scott Strauss. Professor Tihirugaza is a professor and director at the Center for Genocide and Human Rights Research in Africa and the Diaspora at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, United States. And Professor Strauss is a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he studies political violence, genocide, human rights, and post-conflict politics, focusing specifically on sub-Saharan Africa. It's my pleasure to welcome both of you to this podcast, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. So let's start off as a point of reference. So I think it was early on this month we had a mass killing in Uganda, Kampala, where a man had posed as a parent and stabbed four little children between two and four. So I'll start with the lady first. So I'll start with you, Jeanin. How prevalent is this kind of, we hear this in America and other places, how prevalent is this kind of killings in Africa?
Oh, wow. Thank you for the question. It's more prevalent than we really get to document it, especially when our media are not as mature as we would want them to be. So there is a lot that's not documented. There's a lot that's documented for sure. And the big ones that we know, you know, DRC, you have the Rwanda, the Burundi. So there are those that are big ones. But then you have many that are rampant, that happen when people have been really gone through so many atrocities that are not memorialized, that are not healed. So you see it everywhere, absolutely, so many places, and through time, right? So in time and space, we have many of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Scott, let me come to you. Jeanin mentioned something about documentation and how there might be, I don't know if it's, the maturity of the media or this is. So in recent times, we've been seeing a reconstruction of what genocide means or what how we define redefining genocide. So from Jeanin, do you think some of these things we were missing them because we're not properly classifying them as mass killings, or just are we seeing them as isolated, or we're not properly categorizing them? Is that what the case is?
Yeah, I think in general, the attention on conflicts in Africa or some of the major human rights violations that are occurring I think that attention has really diminished in recent years. And so I think part of the issue may be classification, but broadly, there's not the attention on some of the crises that exist that there should be. And I think that's really been a problem. You know, one of the places where I think you can really observe that is the really tragic war that's been happening in Sudan, in the Horn of Africa, where if you compare the kind of coverage and attention and focus and narrative that happened, you know, 20 years ago, even with some, you know, problems with that narrative that happened 20 years ago, compared to the attention and focus and media coverage today, it's a huge gap in focus and attention. And I think that to me is a good example of the kind of attention deficit that we're seeing around the world. There's a lot of things that are competing for people's attention right now. So I do think there is a question of, you know, classification of conflicts. I think in general, when you're outside of the continent and you're looking at least the media and the global north, I think there is, you know, generally conflicts are not covered with much history, with much context. And as a result, I think that the coverage can be quite superficial. And I think that continues to this day. And that's been a constant for coverage of African politics and African conflicts for a long time. So I think that continues. But I do think in addition to that, there is a kind of attention deficit to these crises, which is quite unfortunate.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned Sudan. We've covered Sudan. We must have done about 3 episodes on Sudan. And everyone agrees that Sudan is kind of like underreported and not receiving the same attention that, let's say, for instance, the Gaza or the Ukraine stuff. But then again, there's another aspect to it where Sudan is where it's been prolonged by events or actors that are external to Africa. So where we have several actors that are in there. So, Jean, I wanted you to look at that. We'll in a minute come to the historical mass killings and genocide, but I want to look at how much of the conflict in Africa is also externalized and how much that is affecting how that coverage or how that is being projected outside.
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting that you talk about the internally, how we manage conflicts, how we talk about it, how we communicate about it. And I feel there's some level of numbness, like when a conflict has gone on and just gets transformed into from one thing to another, from one country to another, but it's the same. Then you find that people must take it as usual. So there isn't the it stops shocking. And when it's not shocking, then it's not reported. So when I talk about maturity of media in Africa, inside Africa, it's like, what are you reporting? What's worth paying attention to? And that's rampant, that continues, right? So you have these cycles of violence, cycles of atrocities that keep happening, but at some point, it's like the norm. It becomes like, yeah, here they are at it again. So it's that level of attention that's not given to the tracking of the issues, and so that they are reported with the vigor that they should be reported with. And that's really what I see internally in Africa. How are we reporting this? Are we putting the attention where it should be? That's really what my, and again, the other aspect that I'd like to bring up is silencing. Sometimes atrocities are not reported because there's a lot of silencing internally in that country, in that region. If you say it, then you need trouble, and you risk your life. So there's that too, right? That we haven't dealt with in many parts of Africa. I can give you an example where we tried to bring up to some colleagues of mine and I, we tried to write a book about some atrocities on women. And many people said, no, I can't talk about it in my country. And that tells you what, that was only 2025. If people are still terrified to talk about what's going on in their own countries, it's no surprise that it won't be heard. beyond. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of silencing and speaking of ability to talk, Scott, we've recently, I think it was Germany, because we've seen a heightened, in America, for instance, we were seeing in America, we were talking about reparation now. And the African Union recently had a theme, was it last year? That was also one of the themes. And we see Germany had the historical where they accepted that it was the Herero genocide, where they accepted that. So do you think, following what Ginny was saying, do you think this kind of historical injustice, admitting or accepting these things, do you think it helps in breaking that silence and you know, does it give hope where people can then report these issues? And
Yeah, I think this is such a good point. And I just want to quickly build on something that Janine said in answer to your other question, Michael, if you don't mind. I do think if you look across the continent, there are kind of three, you know, major constellations of conflicts. You have in the Horn, you've got not only Sudan, but you also have Ethiopia and Somalia. Then you look in Central Africa, the Great Lakes region, kind of the Rwanda, Burundi, Eastern Congo, Uganda nexus. And then you look across in West Africa at the Sahel, the kind of Mali, Niger, Burkina, now moving into parts of Benin. Mm-hmm. These are in many ways regional conflicts. I think we have a in political science, at least in my discipline, we would go to them as we think about them as civil wars, but they're embedded in a broader regional dynamic that is really important to capture. You asked about the sort of Sudan conflict, and that is super implicated in a kind of Red Sea Gulf conflict in addition to the region. But each of those conflicts, you can't separate out like one country on its own. They are embedded in a regional environment. And I think that's a really important observation that you made that I just wanted to underline for a second. I think historical recognition is incredibly important because I think not only is it important for the specificity of the recognition of the victims, and also for the specificity of the accountability of and culpability of the perpetrators or their descendants. But I also, as you suggest, I think it is a form of norm setting. It is a way of indicating this is what matters. These are the values that we want to uphold. And I think that does have implications for the present. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier Sudan 20 years ago, if you look at the evolution of the attention to the crisis in Darfur in the early 2000s, a lot of that was motivated by the 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda and a kind of recognition of what had happened there. And then people looked out into the present and they saw, oh, there's something similar happening in Sudan today. So I do think the point is that the recognition and the characterization and the memorialization of past atrocities does have implications for how we talk about and the kind of attention that we give to present atrocities. I think that's a great point. Yeah.
We'll come out to contemporary cases like across. I'm happy how you mentioned these different hotspots and there's two cases that are quite interesting and good for comparison. You mentioned Rwanda, for instance. So look at Rwanda, it's just how many years ago? 94, where they had the genocide. And around the time South Africa gained independence. And we look at the history of apartheid in South Africa. We look at the genocide. So we look at it, look at current xenophobic stuff going on in South Africa and how within the context of the truth and reconciliation, and look at the one that happened in Rwanda. So in my own opinion, I think Rwanda has done well in terms of how it's moved on from, I might be wrong, so you're the expert, so I wanted to look at it. And then how South Africa is dealing with the impact of apartheid continuing to now. So I wanted both of you to look at these two cases and look at how from the historical point till now, how do you compare both cases? Ginny, let me start from you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. If you don't mind, I'd like to throw in Burundi too. To bring this because. You mentioned, Scott, the fact that this is regional. So I think talking about Rwanda without talking about Burundi is really like almost like a missed opportunity. So I'd like to bring that Burundi in it because when we talk about memorialization, and you're right, Michael, we have, Rwanda has done a great job compared to other countries in the region of memorializing, of remembering the past, and really, I can't find a better word than managing, being able to deal with it. So they've done a great job. South Africa is complicated, right? I'll come back to Burundi in a minute. But South Africa is complicated, right? What's being memorialized? What's being remembered? And how, so you, sometimes we only look at the macro level, that like the government, the government systems and so on, but then we don't look at the bottom and see how people live, how are they remembering the past, the pain, the deep wounds, and really, I'm going to give you a tiny example where I traveled to South Africa in Kibera, which used to be, well, I think there's some still call it Elizabeth Province. And I went to visit Mandela Bay, which is beautiful, this area where the Europeans first arrived, British people first arrived. And then, so they set it up as a port and really beautiful. And but they kicked away the Africans who were there. And it was a very fertile land, and they just kicked them away, right? So they installed themselves, and I'll try to make it quick. And then years later, it was renamed Mandela Bay. But in that spot, there's still this pyramid that represents or memorializes a woman called Elizabeth. And that's why the region is called Elizabeth Province. So this was the wife of the first governor of that region. Traveling to that region from India where he was positioned, he lost his wife in childbirth and sent the child back to UK, but continued to where he was being assigned, but his wife died. So he arrived, and it's understandable, a young person mourning his wife who passed away. And so he put this big, you know, pyramid and put the most darling, the most special woman, and all of that. Like good words about this woman he lost. Well, today, why is South Africa still memorializing, mourning this woman they never saw? And then that maybe it's okay. Fast forward, like if you move about a kilometer away from that, there's a big building where people like Steve Biko and other freedom fighters were thrown off the sixth floor to the ground. Like when not Steve Biko, I don't think he was thrown off though, but there are people who died being thrown off the sixth floor, or tortured on that sixth floor of the building. That's just 1 kilometer away, about 1 kilometer. So this building, there's no memorialization whatsoever. Nothing. There was nothing turned into some apartment building for students. I mean, truly, like that discrepancy to me, it broke my heart. Because how can, and young people come to visit that Mandela Bay with this pyramid memorizing Elizabeth, not the queen, the Elizabeth, this wife. And so to me, that's with there's still a problem in memorializing, where the choice of what's being memorized is not equitable. So back to Burundi then, real quick. Burundi, 1972, there was a genocide that took 10% of the population at that time, right? And that's why I lost my father, my brother, and other relatives. Thank you. And then, and that was because Rwanda had a revolution in 1959, a Hutu revolution, that sent refugees to Burundi, Tutsi refugees in Burundi and other parts of Africa, in Tanzania, DRC, and so on. So in Burundi, there was a Tutsi government that perpetrated the genocide. Why? Because they had seen what had happened to Tutsi in Rwanda. And so they had to be ready to plan to reduce these Hutus who could be a threat to them. So then fast forward, so now you have cycles of violence of these people who run around like refugees all around the region who keep coming back to, you know, to want their land. And then again, if you think about it, we're losing people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, every so often. So it's like madness when you think about a place where atrocities keep happening, but there's no memorialization. There's no healing efforts, and there's nothing. Like in Burundi, you walk in, there's nothing that's related to 1972 genocide. And in fact, on April 29, 2025, there was a lot of mourning the Pope, Pope Francis, and please forgive me, this is nothing against the church. This is about facts. There were churches were packed with the people inside Burundi mourning the Pope, Pope Francis, on April 29, 2025, when 1972 genocide started on that day, April 29. There was nothing, no mention of 1972 genocide. And that was 2025. So that's painful when you lose 10% of the population and more flee the country and you don't say anything, you don't deal with it. So,
I'll come up to you with a question.
I'm sorry, I talk too much.
I'll come back to you with a question regarding this. But Scott, same question. How do you see the parallel between...
By the way, I'm super glad that Janine mentioned Burundi in 1972. It's just a case that does not get the attention that it deserves. So thank you, Janine, for raising that. You know, I just want to build on some of the points. I think in some ways, both cases show some of the limitations of the transitional justice approach. Mm-hmm. I think within South Africa, you had a huge example of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and in some ways a model for the rest of the world about how to put the truth forward, to think about moving forward, the importance of forgiveness and so forth. But I think it left a lot of bitterness in South Africa. In addition to what Janine talked about, I think there's a sense that some of the structural inequalities remained in South Africa, the wealth inequalities, and those are racialized wealth inequalities as well. And in addition, you know, some real failures of governance in South Africa since 1994. And I think that the dominance of the TRC narrative has, I think, masked some of the limitations and the frustrations that many South Africans feel. And I think shows us in some ways the limitations of a truth and reconciliation and memorialization being substituting for politics or substituting for economic change and material change. In Rwanda, I think, you know, Janine's absolutely right, and you, Michael, as well, that there has been a huge effort to acknowledge the genocide, to prosecute at a very deep level those who participated in it, both at the international level, but also at the domestic level, both in courts and this innovative justice mechanism called Gacaca. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, to bring back a point that Janine made, there also have been silences in Rwanda, that the overwhelming dominance of the discussion of the genocide has not, there's not been space for talking about crimes that were committed against the Hutu population by those in the current government, both in Rwanda, but also in Congo. And I think when you speak to Rwandans, that's also a lack, a gap, a silence that many many feel and resent. I'm not creating an equivalence here, not saying that it's double genocide or anything like that, but that there is a silence around some of the suffering of the Hutu population in Rwanda that I think has not been given the light that it deserves as well. And I think that's been a limitation on the Rwanda's effort at accountability, justice, and memorialization.
I want to come to something. This question is going to add to Gina, I think to Scott as well. So what we've seen is a continent where the majority of its population are youth, I think, between certain age. And these youth are far removed from that colonial narrative. They're far removed from, and then again, you were mentioning how Ginny, you were saying how the genocide is not one that is the things that are supposed to be at the forefront. So he also speaks to, so I guess, is there a question of the educational system where history is either being omitted Are these intentional, or is this to be manipulated? Because we're seeing again, what we're seeing is some sort of, I'll call them Gen Z. This is our Gen Zs. We've seen in Mozambique, in Kenya, in Nigeria. We just seen this even in the Sahel. You mentioned Sahel. So this is a fight. They're far removed from this, but they don't understand this history. Right. So how do you piece out all of this in terms of, do you think the older generation or these people are manipulating just, or do you think this is so? I'll give an instance, then I'll let you answer. In Nigeria, for instance, when they had the civil war, and after the post-Crushing civil war, so that keeps coming up. We keep seeing new Biafran coming up, but they've not really dealt with that history. Right. So I wanted you to look at how not dealing with the history or how expunging that from the curriculum affects the cycle of conflict.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you brought up the issue of education and revisiting what's in the curriculum. What's packaged in our curriculum, in the education material in African educational systems. We have, if we go, and anybody can look at most of what we use, and this varies, of course, from whether it was a French colony or a British colony or Portuguese and so on. It varies a little bit, not much really, if you go to the bottom of it. It's almost like in some education systems in Africa, we're still teaching the way Europeans taught in the 50s, maybe before the independence, and so that material is completely irrelevant. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that, in the first place, our indigenous knowledge was not included in the educational system, right? Let alone the history that broke us, that hurt us. That was denied, right? Denied, one, by, of course, the colonizers were not interested in the value of the knowledge, African knowledge systems, right? That was like out. But then you find that those of us who were trained in the European system, right, we practice the way we were taught most of the time. And if something comes and shifts the way we view our perspectives on education, we tend to teach the way we were taught, right? So that there has to be some other training that happens in between. And that's why I like to talk about Ubuntu-inspired education. That could get us somewhere. But to this day, most educational systems don't have our history in it. It's a partial history. How they say, you know, many times they talk about, even in the US, the same, the winners are the ones who tell the history, who talk about the conflict and tend to win and put it in the books and in the educational material. So most countries don't write the history the way it should be learned. So our young people don't know. I'm sure between Asghat and me, we have tons of examples where young people you tell them something that happened in their own country, they go, what? And so that's appalling that they don't know their history. They say, if you don't, you know, pay attention to history, it comes back, especially atrocities, history of atrocities, they come back to bite us. And that's going to happen if we don't head on deal with history and bring it to today so we can have a better future. So I think for me personally, I feel like we need all the efforts to memorialize, to remember, like the memory, what's in our memory. It got to have to include the past so that we don't repeat the errors of the past. So anyway, that's how I see it. So young people need to know. Absolutely urgent. There's a sense of urgency to teach, to tell our young people what happened. So it's not irrelevant to today's life.
Can I just jump in on that? Good. I just wanted to quickly say that, you know, I think it's important. I completely agree with Janine, but it's also important to remember that these these memories are political, or at least politicized. And so one of the reasons why there are silences is because of politics, because there are incentives either to promote certain memories or keep other ones silent. And but I think the insight that you're both bringing to this is absolutely right. If you bury the memories, they don't go away. They just take a while to come out. You've seen that, as you say, Michael, in Nigeria. You can see that in Zimbabwe. I think you see that in the Great Lakes. You see that in Ethiopia. And so I think that it is a really important principle to allow the voices of either survivors or their families or families of victims to be able to tell their stories, even if those stories cut against some of the kind of power of the day, the politics of the day.
Mm. I agree with you 100%. I was in Chicago in December, not this yeah, the year before, for a conference, mm-hmm. and I met a PhD student that was doing an amazing project where he's talking to secondary school children of former Biafran, people that have been in the Biafran, how do you remember? That's which I think is very, very interesting, just what you were saying. But Scott, I was going to ask you, one of the actors that have been, especially I've seen the last 25 years, coming to 30 years in Africa, that is behind most of the mass killings, it's what you call a militant Islamist group. Whether you go to the lake, whether it's ADF or you come to the Sahel, a lot of that. Can you speak to that? How that has added to the mass killings or whatever in the last 30 years?
So I think it's really important to distinguish, first of all, among some of the different jihadist armed groups that are on the continent. I mean, they're, you know, even in a country like Mali, you have, or Nigeria, you have different groups with different ideological orientations, different philosophies of governance. You know, if you look across to Somalia or down to Mozambique, you know, we tend to lump them all together as jihadists or Islamist militants or whatever. But I think there are differences between them that are really important to acknowledge. I think that, so the case that I probably know the best would be in the Sahel, started out in Mali, but really broadened across, as I mentioned earlier, into Burkina, into Niger, now into parts of Benin. And the main group there, JNIM, just launched a significant attack on Bamako and has been steadily making headway in that civil war for a number of years now. They're I think, a really interesting group. They have a philosophy of change that is presenting a strong counter to the Western state system and the way that Mali has been governed more or less since the colonial period. Mm-hmm. And they are very heavily invested in governance. It's a form of Islamist governance based on Sharia. But in some of the work that I've done and others, you know, there's a kind of flexible pragmatism in some of the way that they're operating. They have engaged in some mass killings. I wouldn't say that that characterizes the way in which they operate militarily. They tend mostly to attack government officials or military officials. They often avoid direct confrontation, although the recent attacks in Bamako was an exception to that, choosing more guerrilla tactics or squeezing cities, putting kind of embargoes on them to force change and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's important to take them seriously, what it is that they're saying that they're trying to do. I think they tend to be less radical and less violent than some of the Islamic State inspired groups that are on the continent, whether in Mali itself or in Nigeria, that I think have a stricter form of Islam and a stricter form of governance. So I think we're still getting to understand these groups, but I think they are presenting an alternative form of politics and political organization that I don't think is going to go away anytime soon. They are making very significant progress across the Sahel, and they are winning support. And I think that certainly in Mali, but it's also in some other places, the government is really on the defensive. And so it's gonna play out over years, but I think it's gonna be here for some time.
I agree with you. Also, that I studied that group as well, and I've written extensively on that. And there's a book coming, a handbook of jihad, where this editor is looking at a mass number of jihadist movements, and I'm contributing to one of that. And I like what you said, banding them together sometimes helps us. It's not helpful, so it's good to understand each one of them presents. But another thing that has been coming out in the light of the Sahel, we saw what was happening inside with anti-French narratives, anti-Western narrative that is going on. It seems to be like there's a third scramble for Africa. So, and then again, if we look at how that is contributing to maybe the conflict in DRC, where China seems to have been the hegemon in terms of the minerals that are there. So, Ginny, you've been talking about Burundi, and again, when we saw the M23, you know, attacking DRC, Burundi was also kind of somewhat thrown into that mix. So, how do you see this thought scramble for Africa? How does it play into all of this conflict? Do you think that is a credible point?
Oh, absolutely. It is. I mean, when people say follow the money, it's true. Because the conflicts have been now, sometimes people use ethnicity as the reason why people are fighting. But we know, based on what's happening in the Eastern DRC, that it's beyond that. But when another country comes in and eventually becomes like the main producer of these kind of minerals, and there's nothing dug into that you can show in that country that where they came from, it's quite evident that the resources are a huge issue, right? And so I always wonder, and I think this is not new, this is not anything trivial, but the human, there's so much, when we talk about human resources, there's so much to gain from that, right? When we keep humans and who are productive and so on. But when we talk about physical resources, like minerals, people grab those quickly and in a vid ways, and if they have to step on humans and on the way kill them or leave garbage behind, that will kill them anyway. So all of that is indeed motivation for the conflicts to keep going, whether they name it, right? Then they name it and rename it, and but at the bottom line, it's real resources that are killing us all in that region, in the Great Lakes region. And I'm not saying it's the only thing, but like Scott said, there's of course politics, political power that's at stake here. But that's tied closely to the resources, I think. The M23, I feel like, I would say the different groups are being used, that's how I see it. They are being used when really at the end of the day, it's about access to resources, to physical.
Before we come to the last question, Scott, I was gonna ask you, just pulling up on what Ginny said. So we've seen where the space or the state, it's not just the superpowers now. Yeah. It's middle powers, it's Turkey, it's UAE, it's all of these, Iran is that are coming into this space, and you also mentioned politics, the leaders in Africa as well. Some of these leaders, like we've seen in Uganda, where they're consolidating authoritarianism, in Rwanda as well, in Cameroon, where we've had, and besides that, we're seeing some kind of political consciousness among the youth, where the youth are. How do you see all of this dynamics playing out, where people are, how do you see these dynamics playing out in terms of the conflict?
Yeah, I think it's just such a great observation. I'll say two things here. I mean, one is, I think you're absolutely right. We tend to talk about the sort of superpower rivalries shaping Africa, which is true. I mean, you have China, you have the US rivalry, you know, you have, you know, Europe and its legacy on the continent and so forth. But really in the last 10, 15 years, there has been another very important layer, which, you know, we can call middle powers or a new scramble from middle powers. And I think this is absolutely fundamental to the dynamics on the continent, whether it be the UAE, Saudi, Turkey, Morocco, India, and other countries of that side. They see Africa as a place where they can make inroads, both economically, I think also diplomatically. Like, it's an open territory for influence in the world. And as these countries are emerging and as the global order is changing, I think they see a real opportunity, and that's really shaping different parts of the continent. And I think that's gonna be a very important dynamic to come. I think, you know, I think you're asking a great question. This will be my last point to it. I think we're in a period of grand change. I think it's a period where the global order is changing, but I think the structures are changing on the continent as well. Some of that has to do with the huge youth population. I think there's an incredible optimism there. There's a generational shift on the continent. There's a kind of growing confidence and sense that the future is African in some ways, which I think is really exciting. And yet I think the external partners are shifting. I think that Europe is retrenching, the United States is retrenching. China's been involved, but I think is also shifting its politics. You're seeing an influx of new external actors. And whether that's good or bad for the continent, I'm not sure, actually. I think there are potentially some opportunities. I think there are also some risks, but I think it's a period of change. It's a very dynamic period on the continent, and I think really worth our attention. I think it's going to be an exciting period in many respects.
Okay, I agree. So let me start with you, Paul. You know, let's just conclude with this and say, how do you see, with all of this anxiety and stuff, what do you see? How do you see the continent moving forward? But in the short, medium, and long term? And I asked Ginny the same question as well.
Look, I think there are important... Did you want me to speak first, Michael? Sorry.
Yes.
So I think it's really important in this conversation, which we've centered on conflict, it's really important to remember that there are many pockets of the continent that are quite stable and doing really well, right? Whether that be in Southern Africa, whether it be in West Africa or parts of East Africa. And the way I see it, there are pockets of insecurity that are mostly regional to a degree. I think there are some big questions about the regime type for the continent going forward. I think democracy is on a back foot in many respects. And I think that at the same time, many Africans want freedom and they want competition, and yet they've been disappointed by the delivery of what democracy has been on the continent for the last 30 years. And I think that's a big question going forward. I think similarly, there are questions about generational change and how do you create space and opportunity for the large youth population that has a kind of global vision of what's possible through their social media or through their global, you know, informational connectivity. And I think that's going to be a really important dynamic. And then there are really important questions around governance. How are you going to have the kind of delivery of order, of infrastructure, of education, which we talked about briefly, of economic opportunity, of stability and predictability, and the good life that many Africans want. I think that's going to be a real challenge. And I think the states that can figure that out and can provide that order and those public goods and the environment for economic growth, I think, and can manage this complicated external environment, I think that's going to be a really exciting time for those places. And the places that don't, I think it's going to be frustrating for a lot of people and residents in those places.
I agree. I'll go over to you, Ginny.
Yeah, thank you. Since Scott has mentioned governance, so I won't go, I'll skip that one. But I think the umbrella, the main area of hope is really within education. And then I break that down into two sub areas or sub opportunities, two areas of opportunities where we have assets that we really need to capture as Africans, and whether they, from the youth, from all kinds of systems, we need to aim for the right education. First, using social media is a huge asset for us. When they have this little phone, we can use that in educational systems and to achieve so much more. And I tie that with AI. Right? So AI, social media, this is going to be an amazing asset for Africa if they do it the right way, if they are ready for change, to remove that old fashioned, archaic, ancient ways of teaching, where a professor sits in, a teacher sits in front and they are delivering and the students are recipients of it. That's so old and that needs to change. And we have assets here today within social media and AI, right? The aspect, the other opportunity is the youth that Scott mentioned. We have now this large, wonderful population of young people who are ready to work, who are ready to do, right, to produce. But are we giving them the tools to do? And that comes also through education, right? So I think we have, we are set to succeed, to do better, but we have to take the bull by the horns. And I have to say, some of us, les vieux loups, as they say in French, the old, I don't know the word, Lou, the old people, like older generation, will pass, and we have hope in the younger generation in terms of leadership, in terms of change. So that's really how I see it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much, Jeannie and Scott. This has been a very interesting conversation. Some of these questions are not. Like I have the questions, I have the interns prepare the questions, but the way this question is going in the conversation way, I don't know, I just let it take its own, the life of its own. But this has been really eye-opening and very, very deep, because I really appreciate your deep insights into this conversation. And I shared the hope as well, and shared the optimism, because we need a peaceful, Scott mentioned something before, we live in a world that is very uncertain now. There seems to be like a global shift, a global new global order. We don't know what form that it's going to take, but it's an exciting time as well. There are also opportunities within all of that happening. But I really appreciate your time, and I keep in touch.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Great questions and a great conversation. So absolutely. Thank you, and great to be with you, Jeannie, as well.
Same here, Scott. And again, thank you. Great conversation. Yeah.
Obviously, have a great evening. Yeah, I know our king. King Chess was real. I wouldn't go there, but I say good evening from here.
Yeah,
I say good morning to you.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, bye. Great. Thanks again, and love to do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Same. All right. Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in today. This is an interesting and exciting episode with two big scholars on the topic of genocide, human rights, and Africa. Join me as usual to thank Professor Scott Strass and Professor Jeannie Torres-Geza for their time and their rich insights on the subject. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.